nerve pinch beneath my ear. He had a second of trouble because of the extra layers of muscle there, and I got an elbow deep into his stomach and rolled away. The man-choking Johnny dropped him and delivered a textbook-perfect kick to my ribs. I took half the impact, feeling at least one rib go, and spun inside, attempting no elegance as I used my left hand to crush his left testicle. The man screamed and was out of it. I'd never forgotten the stunner on the floor, and neither had the last of the opposition. He scurried around to the far side of the bed, out of reach, and dropped to all fours to grab the weapon. Definitely feeling the pain from the broken rib now, I lifted the massive bed with Johnny in it and dropped it on the guy's head and shoulders. I went under the bed from my side, retrieved the stunner, and backed into an empty corner. One guy had gone out the window. We were on the second floor. The first man to enter was still lying in the doorway. The guy I'd kicked had managed to get to one knee and both elbows. From the blood on his mouth and chin, I guessed that a rib had punctured a lung. He was breathing very raggedly. The bed had crushed the skull of the other man on the floor. The guy who'd been choking Johnny was curled up near the window, holding his crotch and vomiting. I stunned him into silence and went over to the one I'd kicked and lifted him by the hair. "Who sent you?" "Fuck you!" He sprayed some bloody spittle in my face. "Maybe later," I said. "Again, who sent you?" I placed three fingers against his side where the ribcage seemed concave and pressed. The man screamed and went very white. When he coughed, the blood was too red against pale skin. "Who sent you?" I set four fingers against his ribs. "The bishop!" He tried to levitate away from my fingers. "What bishop?" "Shrike Temple. Lossus. Don't. Please. Oh, shit. What were you going to do with him? Us. Nothing. Oh, god damn. Don't. I need a medic. Please." "Sure. Answer. Stun him. Bring him back to the temple. Lossus. Please. I can't breathe. And me? Kill you if you resisted." "Okay," I said, lifting him a little higher by his hair. "We're doing fine here. What did they want him for?"
"I don't know."
He screamed very loudly. I kept one eye on the doorway to the apartment. The stunner was still in my palm under a fistful of hair.
"I don't know," he gasped.
He was hemorrhaging in earnest now. The blood dripped on my arm and left breast.
"How'd you get here?" "EMV. Roof."
"Where'd you cast in?"
"Don't know. I swear. Some city in the water. Cars set to return there. Please."
I ripped at his clothes. No comm log, no other weapons. There was a tattoo of a blue trident just above his heart. "Gunda?" I said.
"Yeah, Parvati Brotherhood."
Outside the web, probably very hard to trace. "All of you?"
"Yeah, please. Get me some help. Oh, shit. Please."
He sagged, almost unconscious. I dropped him, stepped back, and sprayed the stun beam over him. Johnny was sitting up, rubbing his throat and staring at me with a strange gaze. "Get dressed," I said. "We're leaving." The EMV was an old, transparent Vicken Scenic with no palm locks on the ignition plate or disc key. We caught up to the Terminator before we had crossed France and looked down on darkness that Johnny said was the Atlantic Ocean. Except for lights of the occasional floating city or drilling platform, the only illumination came from the stars and the broad swimming pool glows of the undersea colonies. "Why are we taking their vehicle?" asked Johnny. "I want to see where they forecast from." He said the Lusses Shrike Temple. "Yeah, now we'll see." Johnny's face was barely visible as he looked down at the dark sea 20 clicks below. "Do you think those men will die?" "One was already dead," I said. "The guy with the punctured lung will need help. Two of them will be okay. I don't know about the one who went out the window. Do you care?" "Yes, the violence was barbaric." "Though a quarrel in the street is a thing to be hated, the energies displayed in it are fine," I quoted. "They weren't cybrids, were they?"
"I think not."
"So there are at least two groups out to get you, the AIs and the Bishop of the Shrike Temple, and we still don't know why."
"I do have an idea now."
I swiveled in the foam recliner. The constellations above us, familiar neither from hollows of old Earth skies nor from any web world I knew, cast just enough light to allow me to see Johnny's eyes.
"Tell me," I said. "Your mention of Hyperion gave me a clue," he said. "The fact that I had no knowledge of it, its absence said that it was important."
"The strange case of the dog barking in the night," I said.
"What?"
"Nothing. Go on." Johnny leaned closer.
"The only reason that I would not be aware of it is that some elements of the Technocore have blocked my knowledge of it."
"Your cybrid..." It was strange to talk to Johnny that way now. "You spend most of your time in the web, don't you?"
"Yes."
"Wouldn't you run across mention of Hyperion somewhere? It's in the news every once in a while, especially when the Shrike cult's topical."
"Perhaps I did hear. Perhaps that is why I was murdered."
I lay back and looked at the stars. "Let's go ask the bishop," I said. Johnny said that the lights ahead were an analog of New York City in the mid-21st century. He didn't know what resurrection project the city had been rebuilt for. I took the EMV off auto and dropped lower. Tall buildings from the phallic symbol era of urban architecture rose from the swamps and lagoons of the North American littoral. Several had lights burning. Johnny pointed to one decrepit but oddly elegant structure and said, "The Empire State Building." "Okay," I said. "Whatever it is, that's where the EMV wants to land."
"Is it safe?"
I grinned at him. "Nothing in life's safe." I let the car have its head, and we dropped to a small, open platform below the building's spire. We got out and stood on the cracked balcony. It was quite dark, except for the few building lights far below and the stars. A few paces away, a vague blue glow outlined a farcaster portal where elevator doors may once have been. "I'll go first," I said, but Johnny had already stepped through. I palmed the borrowed stunner and followed him. I'd never been in the Shrike Temple on Lussus before, but there was no doubt that we were there now. Johnny stood a few paces ahead of me, but other than him, there was no one around. The place was cool and dark and cavernous, if caverns could really be that large. A frightening polychrome sculpture, which hung from invisible cables, rotated to unfelt breezes. Johnny and I both turned as the Farcaster portal winked out of existence.
"Well, we did their work for them, didn't we?"
I whispered to Johnny. Even the whisper seemed to echo in the red-lit hall. I hadn't planned on Johnny casting to the temple with me. The light seemed to come up then, not really illuminating the Great Hall, but widening its scope so that we could see the semicircle of men there. I remembered that some were called exorcists, and others lectors, and there was some other category I forgot. Whoever they were, it was alarming to see them standing there, at least 2 dozen of them, their robes variations on red and black, and their high foreheads glowing from the red light above. I had no trouble recognizing the bishop. He was from my world, although shorter and fatter than most of us, and his robe was very red. I did not try to hide the stunner. It was possible that if they all tried to rush us, I could bring them all down. Possible, but not probable. I could not see any weapons, but their robes could have hidden entire arsenals. Johnny walked toward the bishop, and I followed. 10 paces from the man, we stopped. The bishop was the only one not standing. His chair was made of wood and looked as if it could be folded so that the intricate arms, supports, back, and legs could be carried in a compact form. One couldn't say the same for the mass of muscle and fat evident under the bishop's robes. Johnny took another step forward. "Why did you try to kidnap my Sybrid?" He spoke to the Shrike cult holy man as if the rest of us were not there. The bishop chuckled and shook his head. "My dear entity, it is true that we wished your presence in our place of worship, but you have no evidence that we were involved in any attempt to kidnap you." "I'm not interested in evidence," said Johnny. "I'm curious as to why you want me here." I heard a rustling behind us, and I swiveled quickly. The stunner charged and pointed, but the broad circle of Shrike priests remained motionless. Most were out of the stunner's range. I wished that I had brought my father's projectile weapon with me. The bishop's voice was deep and textured, and seemed to fill the huge space. "Surely you know that the Church of the Final Atonement has a deep and abiding interest in the world of Hyperion." "Yes." "And surely you are aware that during the past several centuries, the persona of the Old Earth poet Keats has been woven into the cultural mythos of the Hyperion colony?" "Yes. So?" The bishop rubbed his cheek with a large red ring on one finger. "So, when you offered to go on the Shrike pilgrimage, we agreed. We were distressed when you reneged on this offer." Johnny's look of amazement was most human. "I offered? When?" "8 local days ago," said the bishop. "In this room, you approached us with the idea." "Did I say why I wanted to go on the Shrike pilgrimage?" "You said that it was, I believe the phrase you used was, important for your education. We can show you the recording if you wish. All such conversations in the temple are recorded. Or you may have a duplicate of the recording to view at your own convenience." "Yes," said Johnny. The bishop nodded, and an acolyte, or whatever the hell he was, disappeared into the gloom for a moment and returned with a standard video chip in his hand. The bishop nodded again, and the black-robed man came forward and handed the chip to Johnny. I kept the stunner ready until the guy had returned to the semicircle of watchers. "Why did you send the Goondas after us?" I asked. It was the first time I'd spoken in front of the bishop, and my voice sounded too loud and too raw. The Shrike holy man made a gesture with one pudgy hand. "M. Keats had expressed an interest in joining our holiest pilgrimage. Since it is our belief that the final atonement is drawing closer each day, this is of no little importance to us." Consequently, our agents reported that M. Keats may have been the victim of one or more assaults, and that a certain private investigator, you, M. Lamia, was responsible for destroying the cyber bodyguard provided M. Keats by the Technocorps. Bodyguard? It was my turn to sound amazed. Of course, said the bishop. He turned toward Johnny. The gentleman with the queue who was recently murdered on the Templar excursion, was this not the same man whom you introduced as your bodyguard a week earlier? He is visible in the recording. Johnny said nothing. He seemed to be straining to remember something. At any rate, continued the bishop, we must have your answer about the pilgrimage before the week is out. The Sequoia Sempervirens departs from the web in 9 local days. But that's a Templar tree ship, said Johnny. They don't make the long leap to Hyperion. The bishop smiled. In this case, it does. We have reason to believe that this may be the last church-sponsored pilgrimage, and we have chartered the Templar craft to allow as many of the faithful as possible to make the trip. The bishop gestured, and red and black-robed men faded back into darkness. 2 exorcists came forward to fold his stool as the bishop stood. Please give us your answer as soon as possible. He was gone. The remaining exorcist stayed to show us out. There were no more Farcasters. We exited by the main door of the temple and stood on the top step of the long staircase, looking down on the concourse mall of Hive Center and breathing in the cool, oil-scented air. My father's automatic was in the drawer where I'd left it. I made sure there was a full load of flechettes, palmed the magazine back in, and carried the weapon into the kitchen where breakfast was cooking. Johnny sat at the long table, staring down through gray windows at the loading dock. I carried the omelets over and set one in front of him. He looked up as I poured the coffee. "Do you believe him?" I asked. "That it was your idea?" "You saw the video recording. Recordings can be faked." "Yes, but this one wasn't." "Then why did you volunteer to go on this pilgrimage? And why did your bodyguard try to kill you after you talked to the Shrike Church and the Templar captain?" Johnny tried the omelet, nodded, and took another forkful. "The bodyguard is a complete unknown to me. He must have been assigned to me during the week lost to memory. His real purpose, obviously, was to make sure that I did not discover something, or, if I did stumble upon it, to eliminate me." "Something in the web or in Datum Plane?"
"In the web, I presume."
"We need to know who he... it worked for, and why they assigned him to you."
"I do know," said Johnny. "I just asked. The Corps responds that I requested a bodyguard. The cybrid was controlled by an AI nexus, which corresponds to a security force."
"Ask why he tried to kill you."
"I did. They emphatically deny that such a thing is possible."
"Then why was this so-called bodyguard slinking around after you a week after the murder?"
"They respond that while I did not request security again after my discontinuity, the Corps authorities felt that it would be prudent to provide protection."
I laughed. "Some protection? Why the hell did he run on the Templar world when I caught up to him? They aren't even trying to give you a plausible story, Johnny."
"No.
Nor did the bishop explain how the Shrike Church had Farcaster access to Old Earth, or whatever you call that stage-set world.
And we did not ask.
I didn't ask because I wanted to get out of that damn temple in one piece.
Johnny didn't seem to hear. He was sipping his coffee, his gaze focused somewhere else.
What?
I said. He turned to look at me, tapping his thumbnail on his lower lip.
There is a paradox here, Braun.
What?
If it was truly my aim to go to Hyperion, for my cybrid to travel there, I could not have remained in the Technocore. I would have had to invest all consciousness in the cybrid itself.
Why?
But even as I asked, I saw the reason.
Think. Datum Plane itself is an abstract, a commingling of computer and AI-generated dataspheres, and the quasi-perceptual Gibsonian matrix, designed originally for human operators, now accepted as common ground for man, machine, and AI.
But AI hardware exists somewhere in real space, I said, somewhere in the Technocore.
Yes, but that is irrelevant to the function of AI consciousness, said Johnny. I can be anywhere the overlapping dataspheres allow me to travel. All of the web worlds, of course, Datum Plane, and any of the Technocore constructs such as Old Earth, but it's only within that milieu that I can claim consciousness or operate sensors or remotes, such as this cybrid.
I set my coffee cup down and stared at the thing I had loved as a man during the night just past.
Yes?
The colony worlds have limited dataspheres, said Johnny. While there is some contact with the Technocore via Fatline transmissions, it is an exchange of data only, rather like the first information age computer interfaces, rather than a flow of consciousness. Hyperion's datasphere is primitive to the point of non-existence. And from what I can access, the core has no contact whatsoever with that world.
Would that be normal? I asked. I mean, with a colony world that far away?
No. The core has contact with every colony world, with such interstellar barbarians as the Ousters, and with other sources the hegemony could not imagine.
I sat stunned.
With the Ousters?
Since the war on Brescia a few years earlier, the Ousters had been the web's prime boogeymen. The idea of the core, the same congregation of AIs which advises the Senate and the All-Thing, and which allow our entire economy, Farcaster system, and technological civilization to run, the idea of the core being in touch with the Ousters was frightening. And what the hell did Johnny mean by other sources? I didn't really want to know right then.
But you said it is possible for your cybrid to travel there, I said. What did you mean by investing all consciousness in your cybrid? Can an AI become human? Can you exist only in your cybrid?
It has been done, Johnny said softly. Once. A personality reconstruction not too different from my own. A 20th century poet named Ezra Pound. He abandoned his AI persona and fled from the web in his cybrid, but the Pound reconstruction was insane.
Or sane, I said.
Yes.
So all of the data and personality of an AI can survive in a cybrid's organic brain?
Of course not, Braun. Not 1% of 1% of my total consciousness would survive the transition. Organic brains can't process even the most primitive information the way we can. The resultant personality would not be the AI persona, neither would it be a truly human consciousness or cybrid.
Johnny stopped in mid-sentence and turned quickly to look out the window. After a long minute, I said, What is it? I reached out a hand, but did not touch him. He spoke without turning. Perhaps I was wrong to say that the consciousness would not be human, he whispered. It is possible that the resulting persona could be human, touched with a certain divine madness and meta-human perspective. It could be, if purged of all memory of our age, of all consciousness of the core, it could be the person the cybrid was programmed to be. John Keats, I said. Johnny turned away from the window and closed his eyes. His voice was hoarse with emotion. It was the first time I had heard him recite poetry. Fanatics have their dreams, wherewith they weave a paradise for a sect. The savage, too, from forth the loftiest fashion of his sleep, guesses at heaven. Pity these have not traced upon vellum, or wild Indian leaf, the shadows of melodious utterance. But bare of laurel they live, dream, and die, for poesy alone can tell her dreams. With the fine spell of words alone can save imagination from the sable charm and dumb enchantment. Who alive can say, thou art no poet, mayst not tell thy dreams, since every man whose soul is not a clod hath visions and would speak if he had loved and been well nurtured in his mother tongue. Whether the dream now purposed to rehearse be poets or fanatics, will be known when this warm scribe, my hand, is in the grave. I don't get it, I said. What does it mean? It means, said Johnny, smiling gently, that I know what decision I made and why I made it. I wanted to cease being a cybrid and become a man. I wanted to go to Hyperion. I still do. Somebody killed you for that decision a week ago, I said. Yes. And you're going to try again? Yes. Why not invest consciousness in your cybrid here? Become human in the web? It would never work, said Johnny. What you see as a complex interstellar society is only a small part of the core reality matrix. I would be constantly confronted with and at the mercy of the AIs. The Keats persona, reality, would never survive. All right, I said. You need to get out of the web, but there are other colonies. Why Hyperion? Johnny took my hand. His fingers were long and warm and strong. Don't you see, Braun? There is some connection here. It may well be that Keats's dreams of Hyperion were some sort of transtemporal communication between his then-persona and his now-persona. If nothing else, Hyperion is the key mystery of our age, physical and poetic, and it is quite probable that I was born, died, and was born again to explore it. It sounds like madness to me, I said. Delusions of grandeur. Almost certainly, laughed Johnny. And I never have been happier. He grabbed my arms and brought me to my feet, his arms around me. Will you go with me, Braun? Go with me to Hyperion? I blinked in surprise, both at his question and the answer, which filled me like a rush of warmth. Yes, I said. I'll go. We went into the sleeping area then and made love the rest of that day, sleeping finally to awaken to the low light of shift 3 in the industrial trench outside. Johnny was lying on his back, his hazel eyes open and staring at the ceiling, lost in thought. But not so lost, he did not smile and put his arm around me. I nestled my cheek against him, settling into the small curve where shoulder meets chest, and went back to sleep. I was wearing my best clothes, a suit of black whipcord, a blouse woven of Renaissance silk with a Carvenel bloodstone at the throat, a cocked Yulin Bray tricorn, when Johnny and I forecast to TC Squared the next day. I left him in the wooden brass bar near the central terminex, but not before I slid Dad's automatic across to him in a paper bag and told him to shoot anyone who even looked cross-eyed at him. "Web English is such a subtle tongue," he said. "That phrase is older than the web," I said. "Just do it." I squeezed his hand and left without looking back. I took a skycab to the administration complex and walked my way through about 9 security checks before they let me into the center grounds. I walked the half-click across Deer Park, admiring the swans in the nearby lake and the white buildings on the hilltop in the distance, and then there were 9 more checkpoints before a center security woman led me up the flagstoned path to Government House, a low, graceful building set amid flower gardens and landscaped hills. There was an elegantly furnished waiting room, but I barely had time to sit down on an authentic pre-Hegira de-Kooning before an aide appeared and ushered me into the CEO's private office. Mena Gladstone came around the desk to shake my hand and show me to a chair. It was strange to see her in person again after all those years of watching her on HTV. She was even more impressive in the flesh. Her hair was cut short, but seemed to be blowing back in gray-white waves. Her cheeks and chin were as sharp and Lincoln-esque as all the history-prone pundits insisted, but it was the large, sad, brown eyes which dominated the face and made one feel as if he or she were in the presence of a truly original person. I found that my mouth was dry. "Thank you for seeing me, M-Executive. I know how busy you are."
"I'm never too busy to see you, Braun. Just as your father was never too busy to see me when I was a junior senator."
I nodded. Dad had once described Mena Gladstone as the only political genius in the hegemony. He knew that she would be CEO someday, despite her late start in politics. I wished Dad had lived to see it.
"How is your mother, Braun?"
"She's well, M-Executive. She rarely leaves our old summer place on Freeholm anymore, but I see her every Christmas fest." Gladstone nodded. She had been sitting casually on the edge of a massive desk, which the tabloid said had once belonged to an assassinated president, not Lincoln, of the pre-mistake USA, but now she smiled and went around to the simple chair behind it.
"I miss your father, Braun. I wish he were in this administration. Did you see the lake when you came in?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember sailing toy boats there with my Creston when you were both toddlers?"
"Just barely, M-Executive. I was pretty young." Mena Gladstone smiled. An intercom chimed, but she waved it into silence.
"How can I help you, Braun?"
I took a breath. "M-Executive, you may be aware that I'm working as an independent private investigator..." I didn't wait for her nod. "A case I've been working on recently has led me back to Dad's suicide."
"Braun, you know that was investigated most thoroughly. I saw the commission's report."
"Yeah," I said. "I did too, but recently I've discovered some very strange things about the Technocore and its attitude toward the world Hyperion. Weren't you and Dad working on a bill that would have brought Hyperion into the hegemony protectorate?" Gladstone nodded.
"Yes, Braun.
But there were over a dozen other colonies being considered that year. None were allowed in.
Right. But did the Corps or the AI Advisory Council take a special interest in Hyperion?
The CEO tapped a stylus against her lower lip.
What kind of information do you have, Braun?
I started to answer, but she held up a blunt finger.
Wait.
She keyed an interactive.
Thomas, I'll be stepping out for a few minutes. Please be sure that the Sol Draconi trade delegation is entertained if I fall a bit behind schedule.
I didn't see her key anything else, but suddenly a blue and gold Farcaster portal hummed into life near the far wall. She gestured me to go through first. A plain of gold knee-high grass stretched to horizons which seemed farther away than most. The sky was a pale yellow with burnished copper streaks which may have been clouds. I didn't recognize the world.
Mayna Gladstone stepped through and touched the comlog design on her sleeve. The Farcaster portal winked out. A warm breeze blew spice scents to us. Gladstone touched her sleeve again, glanced skyward, and nodded.
I'm sorry for the inconvenience, Braun. Kastrop Roxel has no datasphere or sats of any kind. Now, please go ahead with what you were saying. What kind of information have you come across?
I looked around at the empty grasslands. Nothing to warrant this security. Probably. I've just discovered that the Technocore seems very interested in Hyperion. They've also built some sort of analog to Old Earth, an entire world. If I expected shock or surprise, I was disappointed. Gladstone nodded.
Yes, we know about the Old Earth analog.
I was shocked.
Then why hasn't it ever been announced? If the Corps can rebuild Old Earth, a lot of people would be interested.
Gladstone began walking and I strolled with her, walking faster to keep up with her long-legged strides.
Braun, it would not be in the hegemony's interest to announce such a thing. Our best human intelligence sources have no idea why the Corps is doing such a thing. They have offered no insight. The best policy now is to wait. What information do you have about Hyperion?
I had no idea whether I could trust Mayna Gladstone, old times or not. But I knew that if I was going to get information, I would have to give some.
They built an analog reconstruction of an old Earth poet, I said, and they seem obsessed with keeping any information about Hyperion away from him.
Gladstone picked a long stem of grass and sucked on it.
The John Keats hybrid.
Yes. I was careful not to show surprise this time. I know that Dad was pushing hard to get protectorate status for Hyperion. If the Corps has some special interest in the place, they may have had something to do... may have manipulated...
his apparent suicide?
Yeah. The wind moved gold grass in waves. Something very small scurried away in the stalks at our feet.
It is not beyond the realm of possibility, Braun, but there was absolutely no evidence. Tell me what this hybrid is going to do.
First, tell me why the Corps is so interested in Hyperion. The older woman spread her hands.
If we knew that, Braun, I would sleep much easier nights. As far as we know, the Technocore has been obsessed with Hyperion for centuries. When CEO Yevshensky allowed King Billy of Asquith to recolonize the planet, it almost precipitated a true secession of AIs from the web. Recently, the establishment of our Fatline transmitter there brought about a similar crisis.
But the AIs didn't secede.
No, Braun.
It appears that, for whatever reason, they need us almost as badly as we need them. But if they're so interested in Hyperion, why don't they allow it into the web so they can go there themselves? Gladstone ran a hand through her hair. The bronze clouds far above rippled in what must be a fantastic jet stream. They are adamant about Hyperion not being admitted to the web, she said. It is an interesting paradox. Tell me what the Cybert is going to do. First, tell me why the Corps is obsessed with Hyperion. We do not know for sure. Best guess, then. CEO Gladstone removed the stem of grass from her mouth and regarded it. We believe that the Corps is embarked on a truly incredible project which would allow them to predict everything, to handle every variable of space, time, and history as a quantum of manageable information. Their ultimate intelligence project, I said, knowing that I was being careless and not caring. This time, CEO Gladstone did register shock. How do you know about that? What does that project have to do with Hyperion? Gladstone sighed. We don't know for sure, Braun, but we do know that there is an anomaly on Hyperion which they have not been able to factor into their predictive analyses. Do you know about the so-called time tombs that the Shrike Church holds holy? Sure, they've been off limits to tourists for a while. Yes, because of an accident to a researcher there a few decades ago, our scientists have confirmed that the anti-entropic fields around the tombs are not merely a protection against time's erosive effects, as has been widely believed. What are they? The remnants of a field, or force, which has actually propelled the tombs and their contents backward in time from some distant future. Contents? I managed. But the tombs are empty ever since they were discovered. Empty now, said Mena Gladstone. But there is evidence that they were full, will be full when they open, in our near future. I stared at her. How near? Her dark eyes remained soft, but the movement of her head was final. I've told you too much already, Braun. You are forbidden to repeat it. We'll ensure that silence if necessary. I hid my own confusion by finding a piece of grass to strip for chewing. All right, I said. What's going to come out of the tombs? Aliens? Bombs? Some sort of reverse time capsules? Gladstone smiled tightly. If we knew that, Braun, we would be ahead of the Corps, and we are not. The smile disappeared. One hypothesis is that the tombs relate to some future war, a settling of future scores by rearranging the past, perhaps. A war between who, for Christ's sakes? She opened her hands again. We need to be getting back, Braun. Would you please tell me what the Keet Cybrid is going to do now? I looked down and then back up to meet her steady gaze. I couldn't trust anyone, but the Corps and the Shrike Church already knew Johnny's plans. If this was a three-sided game, perhaps each side should know in case there was a good guy in the bunch. He's going to invest all consciousness in the Cybrid, I said rather clumsily. He's going to become human, M. Gladstone, and then go to Hyperion. I'm going with him. The CEO of the Senate and All Thing, chief officer for a government which spanned almost 200 worlds and billions of people, stared at me in silence for a long moment. Then she said, He plans to go with the Templar ship on the pilgrimage, then.
Yes.
No, said Mayna Gladstone.
What do you mean?
I mean that the Sequoia Sempervirens will not be allowed to leave Hegemony space. There will be no pilgrimage unless the Senate decides it is in our interest.
Her voice was iron hard.
Johnny and I'll go by spinship, I said. The pilgrimage is a loser's game anyway.
No, she said. There will be no more civilian spinships to Hyperion for some time.
The word civilian tipped me.
War?
Gladstone's lips were tight. She nodded.
Before most spinships could reach the region.
A war with the ousters?
Initially, view it as a way to force the issue between the Technocorps and ourselves, Braun. We will either have to incorporate the Hyperion system into the web to allow it force protection, or it will fall to a race which despises and distrusts the Corps and all AIs.
I didn't mention Johnny's comment that the Corps had been in touch with the ousters. I said, a way to force the issue, fine, but who manipulated the ousters into attacking?
Gladstone looked at me.
If her face was Lincoln-esque at that moment, then Old Earth's Lincoln was one tough son of a bitch.
It's time to get back, Braun. You appreciate how important it is that none of this information gets out.
I appreciate the fact that you wouldn't have told me unless you had a reason to, I said. I don't know who you want the stuff to go to, but I know I'm a messenger, not a confidant.
Don't underestimate our resolve to keep this classified, Braun.
I laughed.
Lady, I wouldn't underestimate your resolve in anything.
Mayna Gladstone gestured for me to step through the Farcaster portal first.
I know a way we can discover what the Corps is up to, said Johnny as we rode alone in a rented jet boat on Mare Infinitus. But it would be dangerous.
So what else is new?
I'm serious. We should only attempt it if we feel that it is imperative to understand what the Corps fears from Hyperion.
I do.
We will need an operative, someone who is an artist in datum plane operations, someone smart, but not so smart that they won't take a chance, and someone who would risk everything and keep the secret just for the ultimate in cyberpuke pranks.
I grinned at Johnny.
I've got just the man.
Bibi lived alone in a cheap apartment at the base of a cheap tower in a cheap TC-squared neighborhood. But there was nothing cheap about the hardware that filled most of the space in the four-room flat. Most of Bibi's salary for the past standard decade had gone into state-of-the-art cyberpuke toys. I started by saying that we wanted him to do something illegal. Bibi said that, as a public employee, he couldn't consider such a thing. He asked what the thing was. Johnny began to explain. Bibi leaned forward, and I saw the old cyberpuke gleam in his eyes from our college days. I half expected him to try to dissect Johnny right there just to see how a cybrid worked. Then Johnny got to the interesting part, and Bibi's gleam turned into a sort of green glow.
When I self-destruct my AI persona, said Johnny, the shift to cybrid consciousness will take only nanoseconds, but during that time, my section of the core perimeter defenses will drop. The security phages will fill the gap before too many more nanoseconds pass, but during that time...
Entry to the core,
whispered Bibi, his eyes glowing like some antique VDT.
It would be very dangerous, stressed Johnny. To my knowledge, no human operator has ever penetrated core periphery.
Bibi rubbed his upper lip. There's a legend that Cowboy Gibson did it before the course acceded, he mumbled. But nobody believes it, and Cowboy disappeared.
Even if you penetrate, said Johnny, there would be insufficient time to access, except for the fact that I have the data coordinates.
Fan-fucking-tastic, whispered BB. He turned back to his console and reached for his shunt. Let's do it.
Now? I said. Even Johnny looked taken aback.
Why wait?
BB clicked in his shunt and attached metacortex leads, but left the deck idling.
Are we doing this or what?
I went over next to Johnny on the couch and took his hand. His skin was cool. He showed no expression now, but I could imagine what it must be like to be facing imminent destruction of one's personality and previous existence. Even if the transfer worked, the human with the John Keats persona would not be Johnny.
He's right, said Johnny. Why wait?
I kissed him.
All right, I said. I'm going in with BB.
No.
Johnny squeezed my hand.
You can't help, and the danger would be terrible.
I heard my own voice, as implacable as Mena Gladstone's. Perhaps, but I can't ask BB to do this if I won't, and I won't leave you in there alone. I squeezed his hand a final time and went over to sit by BB at the console. How do I connect with this fucking thing, BB?
You've read all the cyberpuke stuff. You know all about the terrible beauty of Datumplane, the three-dimensional highways with their landscapes of black ice and neon perimeters, and day-glow strange loops, and shimmering skyscrapers of data blocks under hovering clouds of AI presence. I saw all of it riding piggyback on BB's carrier wave. It was almost too much, too intense, too terrifying. I could hear the black threats of the hulking security phages. I could smell death on the breath of the counter-thrust tapeworm viruses, even through the ice screens. I could feel the weight of the AI's wrath above us. We were insects under elephants' feet, and we hadn't even done anything yet except travel approved dataways on a logged-in access errand BB had dreamed up, some homework stuff for his flow control records and statistics job. And I was wearing stick-on leads, seeing things in a Datumplane version of fuzzy black-and-white TV, while Johnny and BB were viewing full Stim-Sim Hollow, as it were. I don't know how they took it.
Okay, whispered BB in some Datumplane equivalent of a whisper. We're here.
Where? All I saw was an infinite maze of bright lights and even brighter shadows, 10,000 cities arrayed in four dimensions.
Core periphery, whispered BB. Hang on, it's about time.
I had no arms to hang on to, and nothing physical in this universe to grasp, but I concentrated on the waveform shades that were our data truck and clung. Johnny died then. I've seen a nuclear explosion firsthand. When Dad was a senator, he took Mom and me to Olympus Command School to see a force demonstration. For the last course, the audience viewing pod was forecast to some godforsaken world, Armagast, I think, and a force-ground recon platoon fired a clean tactical nuke at a pretend adversary some 9 clicks away. The viewing pod was shielded with a Class 10 containment field, polarized, the nuke only a 50-kiloton field tactical, but I'll never forget the blast, the shockwave rocking the 80-ton pod like a leaf on its repellers, the physical shock of light so obscenely bright that it polarized our field to midnight and still brought tears to our eyes and clamored to get in. This was worse. A section of Datumplane seemed to flash and then to implode on itself
reality flushed down a drain of pure black. "Hang on!" Bibi screamed against datum plane static that rasped at my bones, and we were whirling, tumbling, sucked into the vacuum like insects in an oceanic vortex. Somehow, incredibly, impossibly, black armored phages thrust toward us through the din and madness. Bibi avoided one, turned the other's acid membranes against itself. We were being sucked into something colder and blacker than any void in our reality could ever be. "There!" called Bibi, his voice analog almost lost in the tornado rush of ripping datasphere. "There what?" Then I saw it. A thin line of yellow rippling in the turbulence like a cloth banner in a hurricane. Bibi rolled us, found our own wave to carry us against the storm, matched coordinates that danced past me too quickly to see, and we were riding the yellow band into what? Frozen fountains of fireworks, transparent mountain ranges of data, endless glaciers of ROM works, access ganglia spreading like fissures, iron clouds of semi-sentient internal process bubbles, glowing pyramids of primary source stuff, each guarded by lakes of black ice and armies of black pulse phages. "Shit," I whispered to no one in particular. Bibi followed the yellow band down, in, through. I felt a connection, as if someone had suddenly given us a great mass to carry. "Got it!" screamed Bibi, and suddenly there was a sound louder and larger than the maelstrom of noise surrounding and consuming us. It was neither klaxon nor siren, but it was both in its tone of warning and aggression. We were climbing out of it all. I could see a vague wall of gray through the brilliant chaos, and somehow knew it to be the periphery, the vacuum dwindling but still breaching the wall like a shrinking black stain. We were climbing out, but not quickly enough. The phages hit us from five sides. During the 12 years I've been an investigator, I've been shot once, knifed twice. I've had more than this one rib broken. This hurt more than all that combined. Bibi was fighting and climbing at the same time. My contribution to the emergency was to scream. I felt cold claws on us, pulling us down, back into the brightness and noise and chaos. Bibi was using some program, some formula of enchantment to fight them off, but not enough. I could feel the blows slamming home, not against me primarily, but connecting to the matrix analog that was Bibi. We were sinking back. Inexorable forces had us in tow. Suddenly, I felt Johnny's presence, and it was as if a huge, strong hand had scooped us up, lifted us through the periphery wall an instant before the stain snapped our lifeline to existence, and the defensive field crashed together like steel teeth. We moved at impossible speed, down congested dataways, passing datum plane couriers and other operator analogs like an EMV ripping past ox carts. Then we were approaching a slow time gate, leapfrogging gridlocked exiting operator analogs in some four-dimensional high jump. I felt the inevitable nausea of transition as we came up out of the matrix. Light burned my retinas. Real light. Then the pain washed in and I slumped over the console and groaned. "Come on, Braun." It was Johnny, or someone just like Johnny, helping me to my feet and moving us both toward the door.
"Bibi!"
I gasped. "No." I opened aching eyes long enough to see Bibi Serbringer draped across his console. His Stetson had fallen off and rolled to the floor. Bibi's head had exploded, spattering most of the console with gray and red. His mouth was open, and a thick white foam still issued from it. It looked like his eyes had melted. Johnny caught me, half lifted me.
"We have to go," he whispered.
someone will be here any minute. I closed my eyes and let him take me away from there. I awoke to a dim red light and the sound of water dripping. I smelled sewage, mildew, and the ozone of uninsulated fiber optic cables. I opened one eye. We were in a low space, more cave than room, with cables snaking from a shattered ceiling and pools of water on the slime-caked tiles. The red light came from somewhere beyond the cave, a maintenance access shaft, perhaps, or automech tunnel. I moaned softly. Johnny was there, moving from the rough bedroll of blankets to my side. His face was darkened with grease or dirt, and there was at least one fresh cut.
"Where are we?"
He touched my cheek. His other arm went around my shoulders and helped me to a sitting position. The awful view shifted and tilted, and for a moment I thought I was going to be sick. Johnny helped me drink water from a plastic tumbler.
"Dreg's hive," said Johnny.
I'd guessed even before I was fully conscious. Dreg's hive is the deepest pit on Lussis, a no-man's land of mech tunnels and illegal burrows occupied by half the web's outcasts and outlaws. It was in Dreg's hive that I'd been shot several years ago and still bore the laser scar above my left hip bone. I held the tumbler out for more water. Johnny fetched some from a steel therm and came back. I panicked for a second as I fumbled in my tunic pocket and on my belt. Dad's automatic was gone. Johnny held the weapon up and I relaxed, accepting the cup and drinking thirstily.
"Bibi,"
I said, hoping for a moment that it had all been a terrible hallucination. Johnny shook his head.
"There were defenses that neither of us had anticipated. Bibi's incursion was brilliant, but he couldn't outfight core Omega phages. But half the operators in Datum Plain felt echoes of the battle. Bibi is already the stuff of legend."
"Fucking great," I said, and gave a laugh that sounded suspiciously like the beginning of a sob. "The stuff of legend, and Bibi's dead, for fuck all nothing."
Johnny's arm was tight around me. "Not for nothing, Braun. He made the grab, and passed the data to me before he died."
I managed to sit fully upright and to look at Johnny. He seemed the same soft eyes, same hair, same voice, but something was subtly different, deeper, more human.
"You?" I said. "Did you make the transfer? Are you
human?"
John Keats smiled at me.
"Yes, Braun, or as close to human as someone forged in the core could ever be."
"But you remember, me, Bibi, what happened?"
"Yes, and I remember first looking into Chapman's Homer, and my brother Tom's eyes as he hemorrhaged in the night, and Severn's kind voice when I was too weak to open my own eyes to face my fate. And our night in Piazza di Spagna, when I touched your lips and imagined Fanny's cheek against mine. I remember, Braun."
For a second I was confused, and then hurt, but then he set his palm against my cheek, and he touched me. There was no one else, and I understood. I closed my eyes.
"Why are we here?"
I whispered against his shirt.
"I couldn't risk using a forecaster. The core could trace us at once. I considered the spaceport, but you were in no condition to travel. I chose the dregs."
I nodded against him.
"They'll try to kill you."
"Yes."
"Are the local cops after us? The Hegemony police? Transit cops?"
"No, I don't think so. The only ones who've challenged us so far were two bands of Gundas and some of the dregs' dwellers."
I opened my eyes.
"What happened with the Gundas?"
There were more deadly hoodlums and contract killers in the web, but I'd never run across any. Johnny held up Dad's automatic and smiled.
I don't remember anything after BB, I said.
You were injured by the phage backlash. You could walk, but we were the cause of more than a few odd looks in the concourse.
I bet. Tell me about what BB discovered. Why is the Corps obsessed with Hyperion?
Eat first, said Johnny. It's been more than 28 hours.
He crossed the dripping width of the cave room and returned with a self-heating packet. It was basic Hollow Fanatic fare, flash-dried and reheated cloned beef, potatoes which had never seen soil, and carrots which looked like some sort of deep-sea slugs. Nothing had ever tasted so good.
Okay, I said. Tell me.
The Techno Corps has been divided into three groups for as long as the Corps has existed, said Johnny. The Stables are the old line AIs, some of them dating back to pre-mistake days. At least one of them gained sentience in the first information age. The Stables argue that a certain level of symbiosis is necessary between humanity and the Corps. They've promoted the Ultimate Intelligence Project as a way to avoid rash decisions, to delay until all variables can be factored. The Volatiles are the force behind the secession 3 centuries ago. The Volatiles have done conclusive studies that show how humankind's usefulness is past, and from this point on, human beings constitute a threat to the Corps. They advocate immediate and total extinction.
Extinction, I said.
After a moment, I asked, can they do it?
Of humans in the web?
Yes, said Johnny. Core intelligences not only create the infrastructure for hegemony society, but are necessary for everything from force deployment to the fail-safes on stockpiled nuclear and plasma arsenals.
Did you know about this when you were in the core?
No, said Johnny. As a pseudo-poet cybrid retrieval project, I was a freak, a pet, a partial thing allowed to roam the web the way a pet is let out of the house each day. I had no idea there were 3 camps of AI influence.
3 camps, I said.
What's the third, and where does Hyperion come in? Between the Stables and the Volatiles are the Ultimates. For the past 5 centuries, the Ultimates have been obsessed with the UI project. The existence or extinction of the human race is of interest to them only in how it applies to the project. To this date, they have been a force for moderation, an ally of the Stables, because it is their perception that such reconstruction and retrieval projects as the old Earth experiment are necessary to the culmination of the UI. Recently, however, the Hyperion issue has caused the Ultimates to move toward the Volatiles' views. Since Hyperion was explored 4 centuries ago, the Corps has been concerned and nonplussed. It was immediately obvious that the so-called time tombs were artifacts launched backward in time from a point at least 10,000 years in the galaxy's future. More disturbing, however, is the fact that core predictive formulae have never been able to factor the Hyperion variable. Braun, to understand this, you must realize how much the core relies upon prediction. Already, without UI input,